Welcome to Chit Chat Money. This is our Thursday deep dive interview where we interview an analyst covering a single stock. And today we're talking about IAC or Interactive Corp with Ramnik Kundra. If you follow him on Twitter, you might be familiar with some of his work, but it was really good to talk to him. He follows IAC pretty closely and he has a bit of a unique perspective on markets, being that he invests in India as well. Did you have any highlights from the interview?
I think the highlight was looking at everything from a balanced point of view where you got to look at the assets and kind of value them yourself, but also look at the assets from the perspective of how management would look at them from their historical track record and how they've done things in the past. So you kind of got to look at it through their lens. Okay, they like to spin off things. They like to roll up a bunch of assets within these different industries. Okay, how could that play into the future? It's just looking at IAC's history and kind of saying, okay, they have these current assets, what can they do with them today? And understanding that IAC likes to acquire, I guess, sticky or hairy assets that might not look perfect at the time. All around good interview. We cover the majority of what IAC owns.
All right. And before we get to the interview, we want to talk about our friends, our exclusive partner, Seven Investing. You've heard us talk about them before. If you are interested and you already know what they provide, use that code MONEY. You get $100 off the annual. But if you don't, they provide 7 recommendations each month. They've now accumulated recommendations on more than 200 companies. So there's plenty of research. They're very thorough recs as well. And then on top of it, it's not just recommend and leave you to it. They are really collaborative and I don't want to say hold your hand, but they constantly update. And they have meetings each month where you can ask them questions. They have, is it a Discord channel?
Yeah, they have a Discord channel. I'm looking at their recommendations right now. They have their latest best buys that they update in the middle of the month each month to kind of help you out of, all right, of their 200 plus reports, which ones that we've covered before do we think are the best buys today? We won't spoil the picks, but they have a big tech company. We got a space economy company, a few cybersecurity ones, some software, financial services. A good mix of things. And if you like, really, I mean, the 7 Investing reports, they're for all types of investors. So you might not like the coverage from a certain area, or it's not your area that you want to invest in, but I'm sure some of it is because they just have a good plethora of all covering all sorts of areas of the market.
All right. Well, once again, use our code MONEY at checkout. You get $100 off your annual order. And without further ado, here's our interview with Ramnik Kundra.
Welcome to Chit Chat Money. On this show, hosts Ryan Henderson and Brett Schaefer interview industry experts and riff on the world of investing. As a quick reminder, Chit Chat Money is a CCM Media Group podcast. Ryan and Brett are also general partners at Arch Capital, and Arch Capital may have positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. Anything discussed on Chit Chat Money by Ryan or Brett or any other podcast guests is not formal advice or recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the show. We are joined today by Ramnik Kundra. He's a fund manager at Taurus Tax Shield Fund. We got connected through Twitter, I think, like most of our guests. And today we're talking about IAC. But maybe before we get into it, for listeners that aren't familiar with you, could you give maybe some of your background and maybe a little bit of your investing style?
So my background in investing is basically like I started in 2014 in October. That was my first investment was in Under Armour. When I bought the stock zoomed within 6 months and I was like, I can do this. And how I got into it was because I read The Intelligent Investor. And that was through one of the documentaries that I watched on Warren Buffett on Netflix, where he mentioned the book. And I read the book and I read it again. And within 10 days, I read the book twice and bought my first stock. And I thought I have found what I want to do. And then the second stock that I bought was Chesapeake Energy. That went down 90%. So I thought it wasn't that easy as well. So that's it. That's how I started. And, you know, it's been a great journey since then. And in 2018, I started tweeting about my my stocks and my philosophy and my investing style. And Bluegrass Cap, shout out to him. He basically did an FF for me, and that's how kind of the followers, number of followers kind of exploded on Twitter. I'm really grateful to him because I learned a lot from him as well. And that's it. I follow like a timeless timeless principles of value investing. Margin of safety is really important in what I do, and usually try to buy businesses which have good terminal growth and sustainable terminal values. That's it. That's what I'm trying to do.
Okay, let's talk about IAC, and maybe start with the history of the business. How did it get to where it is today? And then follow-up question, how did you discover it as an investment?
So roll-ups, spin-offs, and anti-conglomerate strategy, right? That's what describes IAC. And I discovered it because I was an investor in Charter Communication. And I got to figure out that John Malone and Barry Diller were friends, and then they had a business feud. And, while reading about like Liberty Ventures history, and Liberty Ventures basically was a combination of assets of LendingTree and a little bit of Expedia in it, and some of the other assets that were like taken from IAC. SN was also in there at one point of time. While reading about it, I got to know about IAC, and I got to know about Barry Diller, and since then got really like into it, and always thought like in 2016 that the stock was in like expensive, but like whenever I thought it was expensive, it kind of ripped again and again and again. And in 2018, I ended up buying the stock. And since then, I've been a holder, a shareholder, painfully this year, but it has done still well for me personally. And things go back to like 1986, when today's IAC was basically set up as a Silver King broadcasting company. Within 2 years, it acquired about like 11 stations for $220 million for all of them combined at that time. And later in 1995, Barry Diller took over Silver King from Liberty Media, which was the largest investor in Silver King Broadcasting Company. It was owned by John Malone, and it changed its name to HSN. And Diller wanted to basically build a sort of a platform of companies that could evolve with new media, including the internet, in 1995. And internet was a new thing. And Diller wanted to get on this, hop on this like new paradigm. So he wanted to use all these stations basically as the foundation to launch his company. And he acquired like 80% of the stake in HSN, and then at the same time he acquired Savoy Pictures for pennies on the dollar. It was a failed film studio, and so he was doing this media thing, and then he wanted to be in the internet at the same time. So even at that time, film studio business was considered very risky. But when he learned that movie studio is still a horrible business and it's still very unpredictable business, once again, after owning Savoy Pictures, he showed flexibility and acquired a different kind of asset, an online ticketing business called Ticketmaster. And when they started focusing on internet properties, and then he understood the unit economics part of Ticketmaster, then they changed their name from HSN to USA Interactive to build like interactive ecosystem of companies. And and later that became Interactive Corp, which is today's ISE. And they didn't stop in the middle. They acquired like hotels.com, they acquired hotwire.com, they acquired anyway.com. And then they bundled these travel properties and spun it off as Expedia, right? In about like early 2000, I think it was 2004. And Expedia's success really shaped the firm's strategy as it is today and gave Diller a lot of confidence. And I think he once talked about it as well in one of the like old interviews. And then it acquired properties and, you know, and Expedia's success basically when it shaped it. And then it acquired like TripAdvisor, which was a spin-off along with HSN, and LendingTree, which they bought in early 2000s. That all became part of like Liberty Ventures, which is a Malone venture. And that was converted into GCI Liberty, which was recently in, I think, 2021. Merged into Liberty Broadband, which is a large owner of Charter Communications. So that's how it started, basically. That's how I started with ISE. And basically, when, you know, with all these travel property acquisitions during the late 90s and early 2000s, they had acquired Match Group as well. And I think the acquisition was done in like 1998, it was called Match.com at the time. And I think it was in 1998-99 that they acquired it. When internet speeds and penetrations and acceptance of the internet to have it in every home basically accelerated, they used the Match Group to whatever they had learned from running Match.com to acquire nearly all the dating websites that were coming up and that were important at the time. In 2011, they bought Meetic, later they bought Tinder, then they spun it off all as Match Group. It's basically the same playbook what they did with Expedia, with all the travel websites. So it's basically how the spin-off playbook, I would say, was kind of born.
All right. Yeah, it's a good overview. And yes, Match Group has been their largest spinoff. So it's one of the most important for their long-term returns. But we're going to get into the businesses. But generally, as a shareholder, what are your thoughts on the spinoff strategy? Do you like the flexibility as a shareholder, or are there any downsides there?
I mean, that's one primary driver, right? You look at Berkshire, the greatest holding corporation of all time from a long-term track record point of view, right? And that thing is always trading for less than some of the parts because capital is flowing within the companies. And Buffett argues that the sum is worth more than the parts in Berkshire case. But I doubt if you spin off parts such as Burlington, Northern Santa Fe, and those things won't sell for 25x gap price to earning ratios. And Berkshire really never trades at 25x PE ratio. So still there's a merit in the approach as it makes the structure most resilient, but even if it is not the most optimal structure. So Buffett has clearly indicated, you know, Berkshire is run for maximum resilience rather than maximum optimization, basically. So Barry Diller and Joey Levin understood that very well. They had studied, you know, conglomerate structures. You can tell how they talk within, like in many interviews. So they like to own and nurture a business until it can fly on its own and keep doing this VC type investing with much better strike rate than even the most successful VCs. Right? And they don't necessarily go after moats. They go after businesses that definitely have good free cash flow potential and may not have moats or like huge competitive advantages from terminal standpoint. If you go to a website owner that makes like $100,000 a month in revenue and ask them what their moat is, they would probably look at you dumbfounded regardless of the fact, whether they have the moat or not. So ISE likes to go after such businesses which have like cash flow potential and pay quite low price for them because a lot lot of us don't understand like those metrics, and they just want liquidity of what public markets could offer. So I like this sort of value investing approach, which kind of aligns with my own. Even when you are investing in business that may or may not be profitable at the time you acquire them cheaply or reasonably if you can. And so I'll give you an example of Ask.com. They owned Ask.com. Ask Jeeves was the parent company. And they were doing about like $260 million in revenue and growing more than 40%. But IAC paid 21 times GAAP earnings for the thing. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine someone paying 21x GAAP PE for GAAP EPS for a company growing 40% year over year? That doesn't happen anymore. I mean, we were talking about price to sales of 100x on Snowflake, just last year. So they reached a point quickly where they did $300 million in earnings on an asset that they acquired for $1.8 billion and started using their stock and cash flow to fund other consumer internet acquisitions, including the dating ones.
I guess one of the other... Do you have anything else on the spinoffs?
No. So, I mean, that's where the strategy is basically born. It's just form. This is a company that we are talking about. This is the management that we are talking about. The spinoff strategy that I'm talking about. So, this is the management that you would want to basically bet on. And they want to get the maximum out of the asset that they can, and more than what they had paid for it, including using debt, stock, cash combination, and it pays out for itself. Because eventually businesses exist. We forget that a lot of time. Businesses exist to generate cash flow.
So I guess one of their businesses now is Dotdash Meredith, and I think we're basically just going to go through a bunch of their different portfolio companies and kind of take them one by one. So let's start with Dotdash Meredith. Right now, pro forma revenue is down around 15-20% this year. Do you think this can reverse? And what sort of profitability do you think Dotdash Meredith could have if things normalize?
So I basically looked at like Meredith's statements when IAC acquired them. I skimmed through them. The overall business had 20% EBITDA margins, including low margins for their print business, right? And but the management in one of the con calls said that more than 65% of their EBITDA comes from digital properties, which was $260 million at the time, and accounts for more. So that means basically digital properties are doing about 36% EBITDA margins. And I think with operational improvements, including the improvements in loading time for the websites that basically Joey Levin talked about, I think they will attract more users. The management guided to $450 million in EBITDA at the time of the acquisition. I think it was just the sum of Dotdash and Meredith's EBITDA rather than like, they were like, lowballing the stuff, but they didn't know the bubble would burst and the recession would be here. And now, one year forward, we are looking at a revised guidance of $300 million, which is like one third lower than what we were expecting. But talking about margins, I like to assume like they could go back to be even better, because IAC has previously showed cost discipline during these times. And whenever the traffic is better and the advertising is back and we have more visibility, I think things can go back pretty quickly from here.
What are the assets, though? I think listeners will recognize them, so they might be confused on what Dotdash Meredith is. But what are some of the assets that both of these units own, just so people can understand what sort of websites that IAC is super interested in?
So one of the assets that they have is Better Homes and Gardens. And one of the assets is the Spruce that they have. These were all part of the Time acquisition that they did. So, I mean, these are some of the popular ones. They have one called health.com.
Is Investopedia in there?
Yeah, Investopedia is part of Dotdash, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And what are your thoughts about their, they talk about the how they can get double kind of the ad efficiency with these Meredith properties. Do you see any reason why that wouldn't be the case? Or just because the sites they're acquiring are so similar, do you think that, you know, the CPG strategy, the referral stuff that they do that's really helpful, do you think that, is there any reason that wouldn't, you know, be the case as we kind of get out of this recessionary environment on advertising?
So I think hard part would be because it's very hard to actually make the case that, they would have any trouble, because Joey Levin at the time said that, like, you know, a normal website of theirs, like Investopedia, takes about 3-4 seconds to download. And these websites from Meredith, which have like even more traffic, like 2x, 3x time, 3x the prof, visitors, still have loading times of about 23 seconds, 24 seconds. And that is just crazy. So they just improved the, and they, he said that it's just very, very easy for us to change that. And if they can do that, and if they can do that without harming the user experience, I don't see any reason, why the ad loads would have problem for them. Even with less ad loads, they could command like higher CPMs or CPCs, in my opinion. But there is definitely a range of outcome can be produced where you have things going, south, in which case, which are pretty much unknowable at the time, at right now. But a recession can prove out in very different ways than we can imagine. So I don't really have a good answer for it. But I don't see why things cannot get back very quickly.
Right. Okay. And next topic, it'd be Angie. This is the thorn maybe in the side of a lot of IAC investors. This is the, just for reference, they own like 85% of this thing, but the rest is publicly traded, so we can see what it is trading at in the public markets, and it's done quite poorly. I guess as someone who owns IAC, and correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't own Angie, how do you value Angie? What do you think about this when you're, as the shareholder of the conglomerate company?
Well, the smart thing is that you don't, right? You don't value Angie.
Yeah, you value it at zero.
I don't. I don't have strong views on the market that it caters. I just think that they have still been unable to find the value proposition for their service providers and even the ultimate consumers. So when I was living in New York, someone just told me like Handy is a service, and I called once the guy from Handy, and they offered me a discount, and they did like great service for like $70, like the whole house was clean and everything. But at the same time, next time I just called the guy.
Yeah.
So like it's anecdotal as well. It's good thing that I never fell for the Angie narrative. But at the same time, they it's been about like 2-2.5 years. Now they introduced their fixed price offerings where the customer would know upfront what he has to pay or she has to pay. And the service provider has to provide the service in a given amount of time. And that's not had much traction. It was launched with much fanfare, but hasn't had much traction. So I don't think anyone except the management here is competent enough to value it. There may be a few smart people who could do it. I just can't. So I just leave it alone.
Could you see them buying it back in full? Again, this is speculation, buying it back in full at these lower prices, take that whatever 15% left and just make it a part of IAC so it's not publicly traded anymore?
I think if they do that, they're going to have even a lower stock price. Because people already hate Angie a lot, and they're like,
they do.
You see Angie and you don't see anything else in the market right now at this price. So it's a tricky situation. I don't think they are going to take it private and wreck their stock even further. It's already down like 67-70%. I think that's enough of beating. I think that's already embarrassing for this kind of management.
And if I'm not mistaken, Joey Levin just replaced the CEO of Angie, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And is he just taking over like operations there himself?
Yes. And I don't think it's like an offensive kind of a move. I just think it's very chaotic kind of a move, because this guy was appointed last year. And that's just horrible how things have panned out at Angie. I mean, I'm laughing. It's one of my good positions. But like, it's just being a clown show.
Yeah. So that's probably maybe their worst asset and one of the best ones, Ryan. I don't know. We want to talk about Turo, because that's a bit more optimistic here.
Yeah. I think this is one people are probably, or investors are probably a little more excited about. So they own roughly 35% of Turo. What do you think, I guess, broadly, what do you think of Turo? And then what do you think could be the upside if Turo goes public?
So I think the best time to look at total addressable market for various sustainable platforms with good value propositions like that of Turo's is actually today than it was in 2021. People were using EV to TAM and EV to sales and those kind of multiples. I think now is the time where you go on this kind of offense when, things like Google and Amazon are falling like more than 10% a day. And so this is probably, capitulation that we saw like two days straight. Anyway, for Turo, I think everyone in 2021 wanted to, do the EV to TAM thing. But now everyone is just looking at PV ratios. And Turo's total addressable market, the TAM, is very large. And Turo is basically the world's largest car sharing marketplace, where you can book a car you want. Basically, as people call it, it's the Airbnb for cars. The management thinks its TAM is over $200 billion for trips over 30 miles, which roughly is 25% of the total miles traveled, right? And you have many options to choose from among many cars. They have about 100,000 hosts on their platform and 175,000 listings, with last year's revenue was something like $390 million, or like something like $400 million. I don't remember it exactly, but I looked at it like 6 months ago. I don't remember it. The gross margins for Turo have also gone up every year since 2019, from 15% now to about like 35% last year. And also they're growing. Their operating margins are also inflecting upward, which is kind of surprising, because you look at all these internet companies, burning cash, and this thing is profitable, and makes me even like IAC even more, because they are going after profitable stuff and still growing. Like, and it's not like the top line is stalled or like they are under investing, stuff like that. It's just like they don't have crazy sales and marketing budget like other internet companies, and they are being very smart about going after this market, because they are kind of the only player, large player in the market at the moment.
Yeah, and I'm booking a trip right now, and I got to say that the platform's pretty sleek and it's intuitive, and I feel like everyone wants away from the rental car companies. So it kind of just has a good product market fit.
Yeah. And just back to the IAC part, they're holding it at about $250 million right now. I think part of the thesis for owning it today, look, we don't know when Turo's going to go public or if someone's going to acquire them or whatever, but I guess it's hard. Do you see this stake? Could it be worth $1 billion? Could it be worth even more? I mean, is that part of your thesis for owning it today, or is it more of trust management? They'll do the right thing with this asset.
Yeah. So if you own IAC, first of all, you have to trust the management. That's like the primary driver of this thing. Like I said, they don't invest in moats. They don't invest in, they don't think about like terminal values of the business a lot. As you can see from the assets like Angie, and you can see from other assets that they own, like in emerging, very, very small niche businesses and kind of boutique businesses that they like to own, which generate cash flows. And so Turo is basically growing profitably. Like it's growing not only gross margin wise, it's growing operating margin wise, and it's growing like double and triple digits. Like the last I checked, it had grown like triple digits in over 2 year time frame. And we still are in very early innings of this for this company. And IAC's stake is about like 27%, which they paid a little like $250 million, as you pointed out, for that. And I think that could be worth, you know, far out, not in this environment. They're not going to IPO. Like people keep talking about it. They're not going to IPO. They're not stupid. If they do that, I'm going to sell IAC, like in this environment. But like they would probably, you know, sell it like, how they sold Vimeo at the top, like, and that's like far out. And 10 years from now, 5 years from now, I think Turo would be in good place and IAC stake would be worth much more than $250 million that they paid for it. And they'll have good IRR on it, I think, because Turo is already doing about like $400 million in revenue.
What are your thoughts of them acquiring even more or the entire thing? Since they have the cash to do it, would that be a positive signal? Or do you think, I guess, again, it's just trusting management, but any thoughts on that happening?
I think in this case, like in Angie's case, I said it would be a negative. Like in this case, it would be a positive because the asset is growing like crazy. Yeah. And if the numbers, I haven't looked at the most recent quarter or anything because I don't think they reported, but like, you know, if you have this company growing like how it was growing from 2018 to 2020, or even a little less than that, like people are going to love this asset in this environment because you could probably get it from the private players for much cheaper, private investors for much cheaper.
Right. Yeah. Right. If they were able to take it public in 2021, 2020 timeframe, that I think they would have got quite the premium on it. Just looking at the
S1. They did the S1 what, right? Yeah, it's poor timing. Right when the market turned over. Right? It was January, I think, if I'm getting that timeline correctly. So right when the market turned over in 2021, or even later. I can't, if I'm not.
Just right after kind of the mania.
Or yeah. Unless I'm getting the timeline wrong.
They got one right? Like they got Vimeo absolutely right. Like they still Vimeo at $56, the thing traded at like $4, like a few days ago.
Yeah. That was kind of the peak of the SaaS. We'll pay whatever we want for that. All right. So one of the interesting assets that maybe was unexpected that IAC bought, but has worked out really well so far, has been MGM Resorts. Not really in their typical, I don't know, area of expertise over the last few decades, but right now it's a really important part of this business because the asset or their investment is worth approximately half of IAC's market cap as of this writing. Generally, what do you think of the partnership? Where do they go from here with the investment?
Yeah, so MGM's public equity buy was an odd one for many investors, but you know, as I said, these guys are value investors. They buy fear and they are contrarian of sorts. They think of themselves as capital allocators rather than, you know, sticking to any kind of dogma. They are not dogmatic in any way. They can go after any opportunity that they want, you know. So during the depth of the COVID panic in the markets. And they bought MGM at 4x pre-COVID EBITDA. So now I like that move for two reasons. One, that you are value guys who bought the panic, and even today you are up on your investment after the drawdown that we have seen in the current market. And two, I like it because MGM has 50% ownership of BetMGM, which is tapping into a huge online betting and iGaming market. And also, MGM is one of the most profitable, not one of the most profitable, but the most profitable collection of retail casino properties. It has only 20 properties, while Caesars has 60, but MGM has $2 billion of EBITDA, EBITDA plus rent costs, and Caesars has about 3.6 billion. So with only one third of the properties, MGM has more than half of the profit of what Caesars does. And Caesars is also efficiently operated now. So you see MGM is well managed, as it has about three out of, you know, five most profitable Vegas assets, including the Cosmopolitan, Bellagio, and MGM Grand. And it has 50% share of Vegas gaming market. In iGaming, many companies like Penn Entertainment and DraftKings are making progress, but MGM has good distribution and they are trying to do it profitably. They are also burning through a lot of cash, but that's for a lot of growth as well. So they are reaping benefits for burning that cash as well. And a lot of companies, like Wynn Resorts and other companies, keep coming out and say they are doing stuff in iGaming and online sports betting, but you don't see a lot of moves from these companies in the market or making any kind of buzz in the market. So like BetMGM and DraftKings and Penn, these are quite formidable competitors, all three of them. But I would say BetMGM is doing pretty good, as they are growing like triple digits year over year. In my view, MGM also has MGM China, which is down quite a lot because of the sentiment again. MGM China, it's a separate stock that's listed, I think, on Hong Kong Stock Exchange, and it's like down a lot, about like 80%, because of the sentiment against China at the moment. And, if you compress MGM's margins, and you get to a valuation of 18 times free cash flow at the current $34-$35 that it trades at. So for these properties, which are gambling properties and sports betting properties, which have kind of Lind effect to them, and they would take more than twice and thrice to build in the current inflationary environment if you were to rebuild the whole stack of properties that they own. These have high terminal values, and I think MGM, if they get the BetMGM part operationally better, that would even do wonders, and it probably eventually spin it off from MGM.
Okay, last subsidiary that to talk about, or the last portfolio company that I think is worth talking about, is Care.com. What are your thoughts around that business? It seems like it's been pretty successful. Do you think that can continue?
Yeah, so Care.com is one of my favorite buys that they've done, because I had just started buying the stock, and they were already acquiring Care.com at that point. So I see, again, like value investors and like contrarian investors bought the panic, like they did with the MGM when everything, related to COVID and would be related to COVID headwinds was falling down, like restaurants, the casino resorts and hotels, etc. Is the same kind of buy. So it was a special situation of sorts. So on care.com, Wall Street Journal basically published an article and came out with a piece in 2019, I think, early 2019, questioning care.com's due diligence and background check processes, where they found a bunch of people and caretakers who were not who had not gone through proper background checks that care had claimed that they do. And as the company was implementing, you know, new oversight processes because of the case and because of the shareholder pressure, IAC grabbed care for 3x sales in the middle of the chaos. So when I looked at the time of the IAC's acquisition, I remember that care had about like 70% gross margins. And, you know, they had about like 17%, 18% free cash flow margins. So this was already a profitable company, like Turo, like MGM. So like Meredith and Dot Dash, all those kinds of like properties. And on GAAP basis, GAAP PE ratio basis, basically, like GAAP EPS basis, IAC bought a best-in-class platform in care for 12 times GAAP earnings, right? It's and the platform was kind of stagnating under the weight of the management and kind of undercapitalized by being public company. And no one was able to like grow this thing, but IAC thought like they could use their operational excellence and their capital to improve this business a lot. So also the management at Care at the time also owned about like 25-26% of the stock, and I think over the next 2 years Care grew more than 100%. We'll see how things pan out over time, but this is already a platform that is very, very profitable, and I think going forward can do wonders for IAC, because this was acquired for $500 million, and this could be multiples of what IAC basically paid for it. So we have like multiple levers in IAC at the moment. Like you have Meredith Dot Dash, you have care.com, you have Turo. These all things could be worth multiple $1 billion in themselves. If ever it turns around, you'll have a home run. And if you don't, like IAC will do pretty well from here, in my opinion.
Right. That leads to kind of the wrap up questions. You know, a big part of IAC is management. You already talked about how you have to trust them going forward. I mean, what do you think of Levin and the team today? I know Diller's kind of out of the picture more. He's kind of, you know, he's hanging in the background. And I guess the other one, is a bear market a good thing for them being able to pick up some assets, maybe at a lower valuation? And I guess we don't need to go through some of the parts, but any sort of valuation reference, I guess, would be in this question as well, kind of to wrap things up.
I like these guys. Recently, Joe Levin said in an interview that anything is possible for us. We can invest anywhere and we will, depending on whether it makes sense. Levin is a capital allocator, as I said, who applies timeless principles of value investing in doing deals, and they keep huge margin of safety when they acquire any assets, so they don't have any problems that usually most of the roll-ups over long-term have. Usually a bear market, I would say, has always served them well. This time, I dare say, it is a bit different, because in his letters, Levin said once or twice something like, private markets are crazy. And Diller, in one or two interviews, also echoed the same sentiment. And he said, basically, private markets are going insane. And they have been saying that stuff since 2019. And if I remember correctly, in their letters and in their interviews, but didn't find anything in tech. They bought Meredith right before the bubble in tech popped, where they could have made a better return. But you can never tell when these bubbles will pop, right? I'm just happy that despite being a key player in the consumer internet space, ISE never bought in the hype of SaaS and consumer internet and, you know, things selling for like 10x sales or 100x sales. Even rather it sold Vimeo at the top. And they basically sold Vimeo during the euphoria. I remember listening to Levin's con call, or maybe reading his letter, in which he said something like, while we don't value things based on sales multiple, but we find an appetite among some market participants to do so. And that was like such a great way to put things in perspective, how they think about things. Because you don't really get management investing in internet and saying these kind of stuff, these kind of things. And I think that was like the most respectable home run in hindsight. You want people like that basically running the businesses that you own. So I really like the management, and I would like them to do what they're doing. And they could actually raise capital in this environment and do some deals.
Yeah, I think we echo that sentiment. Last question, pre-mortem, and we try to ask this for all of our deep dive interviews. How could an investment in IAC go poorly?
As you said, rightly, the main part of investing in IAC is trusting the management, right? Like. And you may go wrong at some point trusting just the people, because it's not that people are just people could turn out to be crooks, but at the same time, people could just lose talent or they could just make bad judgment themselves. And in turn, you will suffer for their bad judgment because you trusted them. So see, these assets that ISE own that we have talked about are not the rating agencies or paint companies. And these are not like old moti businesses. These are businesses that you cannot underwrite being in business forever. So the terminal value of these businesses is quite low, if I were to guess. But you are betting on the management that they keep the machine going and eventually find one or two match groups that work even better with the free cash flow they will generate from their investments, and most likely today from Meredith's and DotDash combination. That could be possible. But you have to trust the management on this thing. And that's how, if the management makes a mistake, you basically will suffer hugely and dearly for their mistake. And they, at this point, they cannot even take even one punch, basically. So we are at that point.
Okay, well, I think that's all the questions we have. Ramnik, appreciate the time. If people want to keep up with you, I know Twitter's a good place. Do you know your Twitter handle?
Yes, it's iRamnik, iRamneek.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you once again for coming on. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. We want to remind listeners that Brett and I are not financial advisors. Anything we say or discuss here on Chit Chat Money is not formal advice. We are, however, general partners at Arch Capital, and clients do have a position in the security discussed in this podcast. We are
shareholders. May or may not in the future, though.
Make sure. May or may not in the future, but we are IAC shareholders at the time that this was recorded. So keep that in mind, and it's not formal advice or a recommendation. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Ramnik, again, for coming on the show. We'll see you all next time. Hey, Simon, we wanted to ask you a few questions about 7Investing so listeners could get an idea of what they're getting. What inspired you to start the company, and what exactly is 7Investing?
Well, hey, Ryan, thanks again for having me. You know, we, from years of working in the investing industry, it was inspired by conversations with people that would just always have kind of the same negative perception of the stock market, right? It's too hard, or I don't have time for this, or this is stacked against me. And those conversations kind of led me to say, hey, we need to create a site that actually does inspire people to say, you can take control of your financial future. you can invest in stocks. You can find good stocks to buy and hold for long periods of time. And at the end of the day, too, we know that everybody is different. We don't believe that there is one stock that fits for everyone, right? Maybe you're a dividend loving, you know, paycheck cashing income investor that might want an option that's going to be a lower risk dividend paying stock, especially right now with the economy being what it is. And then other people might say, hey, you know, I'm ready to hold on for 20 or 30 years. I want to take some swings for the fences. Let's go after those high growth opportunities. And so I said, you know, this would be something that would be even more fun rather than just doing it educational and by myself. I said, what if I brought together a team of seven advisors, all with a diverse background and a diverse perspective of the stock market, so we could uncover more stones and look at a bunch of different stocks with a bunch of different investing styles and a whole bunch of different industries. And so Seven Investing is kind of the genesis of all of those that we started in March of 2020. And we said, let's look at a whole bunch of different stocks. Let's do the legwork of the analysis and let's present our seven favorite actionable ideas every month for investors to choose from. And let's start the conversation about which of these stocks is right for you and which one might be the right fit for your portfolio, knowing that investing is a very personal thing.
All right. If you are a subscriber of Seven Investing, what do you get? Can you give an overview of what subscribers get?
On the very first of every month, Brett, we release our seven new recommendations. So we are coming up on October 1st here, at least in the recording of this. And, you know, on October 1st, we'll release seven recommendation reports. Some of them will be low risk. Some of them will be high risk. Some of them will be biotech. Some of them will be financial services. We run the full gamut. And as a member, you get immediate access to all of the new reports. But you also get access to all of our old recommendations as well. We track all of them in real time on our scorecard at seveninvesting.com/recommendations. And we also provide company updates on all of those previous recommendations as well. We check in on how things are going. And sometimes we even see red flags that we think people should be aware of. There's risks for any opportunity at the time that you recommend it. And sometimes it's really needed for investors to kind of understand the risk and reward relationship. And then the last part of it is, in addition to issuing new recommendations and providing updates on them, is we know that this is a long-term journey. We know that investing is something that we want to take years, if not decades, to accomplish whatever we want to get to as the end goal. And so we always, every month, make it a point to be very available for our subscribers to ask us questions. We have a members-only call right in the middle of every single month. We have a community discussion forum that we have available 24/7 to not only talk to our advisors, but also other investors. I think that's one of the key differentiators for Seven Investing is that, you know, we know this is a long-term journey. We know it's a very personal thing. We know they're going to have questions along the way. We don't want to just broadcast stock picks and disappear. We want to be here with you throughout this entire journey.
And you mentioned, so seven recommendations each month. Sometimes those might be repeats, but obviously there's a lot of companies now in the Seven Investing universe. So how do members get a grasp on the advisor's conviction around certain ideas? Like which ones do they have a way of knowing which whether advisors like certain ones more?
That's the most common question we've gotten actually since we started is what's your favorite ideas right now? You know, we've done the diligence on almost 200 unique companies now and put them on the scorecard. And people would say, hey, this is too much to keep up with. How do I even know where to start? And so we've kind of evolved as a company. One thing that we've started doing is best buys every month. Each advisor gets to pick any of their or another advisor's previous recommendations and put the flag on it that says, this is my best buy for October. And we publish those for subscribers. The other thing that we've started doing is issuing conviction ratings on companies that are also right there on the scorecard. So if you see a previous recommendation, we go everything from potential sell, which is the most negative flag we can put on a stock, to strong buy, which is the most positive bullish flag that we can mark things with. And you can filter through all of those to really quickly see, here's some of our favorite opportunities. And we've taken this even one step further now, Ryan, which is we've created a strong buy portfolio where every quarter now we've gone ahead and self-selected as a team through a pretty methodical process, our 20 favorite ideas, our 20 highest scoring companies that we've collectively come up with, our favorites of the entire scorecard. And we put these into what we're calling a strong buy portfolio that we publish each quarter, also available as an added benefit for no extra charge for 7 investing members.
All right, last question here. What does it cost to become a 7 investing subscriber? And as a, you know, we'll talk about, or we have talked about before, if you're a listener, use code MONEY to get $100 off your annual subscription.
That's right. Yeah, we do have a monthly option. You know, you can come in and check out the entire scorecard for a month just to see what you're looking at for $49 a month. But our most popular plan is actually the annual option because it's at a discount to that. In fact, we've got a discount on the discount, like you mentioned, Brett. $399 for the year is our annual option price. But if you use money, the Chit Chat Money promo code, it's down to $300. So you're basically getting the subscription for half price if you sign up for the annual offer with that promo code. That does not expire after the first year. As long as you remain an active subscriber, you get to lock in that $100 off a year benefit.
All right. Well, as he mentioned, use that code MONEY. Thanks for joining us, Simon.
Thanks very much for having me.